tremendous is before joining the cooperative, a lot of the women were earning maybe $7 to $10 an hour doing cleaning, sometimes being asked to do childcare at the same time, which is difficult to do both. And now in CSIP, whether they're earning between, you know, $20 to $25 an hour, depending on how much they work. Some people choose to do full time, some part time. So it's been a tremendous leap income wise, which of course affects their family, you know, situation.
I'd like to pick up on many dimensions of what you said, but here's a couple. I'm struck by what you say about the ability of these women in that co-op to find clients, folks who will buy the services they're producing, who want not just to get their place clean, their store, their factory, their office, whatever it is, but who also want to buy something from an entity whose way of organizing work they want to help. In other words, it gives them a competitive advantage in the marketplace that they, in a sense, offer a customer two things, the cleaning service, but also the chance to help build a co-op sector in the community. And for many clients, this matters. This isn't a, they would make a choice for a co-op rather than a conventional business.
That's right.
Because many folks wonder whether a co-op can succeed in the capitalist marketplace. You're basically saying,
it's
here's
super
one that
competitive.
Did.
Yeah, absolutely. It's incredible. And I think it has to do with the fact that, you know, there, people are really seeking out, you know, how to have a relationship with the person that's engaging with them and their family and their home, and not to hire somebody from an agency where there's a middleman and everything's very vague and they don't really know what's happening. And to know that it's women not just cleaning, but they're also producing a product right now, a cleaning product. They're becoming leaders. They're in the forefront of the network that you mentioned. So it's much more than that. So I think people really buy into all of that. And so they're very different. They set themselves apart very much from all the other cleaning companies in New York City that exist.
Tell our listeners and tell me, how has the business grown over the years that it has? Give us a sense of a little mini history of this effort. How many women have been involved over time? What changes in the way they're functioning have you observed? How have you helped them? A little bit of the history.
Yeah. So it started out, as I was saying, with 15 members, and over probably the first year and a half was a very challenging time where they had to get things going and really develop themselves and their reputation in the marketplace. After about a year and a half, the demand was so high that they couldn't meet it, so they brought in 10 new members, so they became 25. And actually, since 2008, they've grown to 60 members in the cooperative. 60. They just brought in 10 people. They just finished a probationary period that's 3 months long. It's very intense where they train them to do cleaning. And through the years, you know, I've seen tremendous, you know, challenges come up and learnings, things having to do with, you know, the complexity around decision making in the co-op and having, you know, 30 people in the room and really figuring out a way to hear all the voices as in worker co-ops, you know, everybody has a vote. So they've sort of played around with majority vote, with consensus decision. We've provided a lot of trainings and those things, how to be effective communicators, which is very tricky in a co-op. But that's the goal. So they meet every other week for the last, they've met every
other
week.
They being all of them.
All of them. They're very into being very participatory. They do have committees, like a leadership committee. There is a training committee and also a publicity committee that oversees, you know, kind of the vision and keeps things going. But they're very committed to meeting every other week for the last 8 years and still do, to really talk about what's going on with clients, with members, issues to resolve, challenges that come up. So we've been there, you know, along the way. Obviously, our relationship changes because they need us less, and that's our role as an incubator. But we've trained them in doing the back office. Again, we do many trainings. We come in and do consultation on different, like, issues that come up around management and governance issues. And we share a space. So we're very in tune to one another in terms of what's going on. And I think they're going to continue growing because the demand just continues to come. They've increased their client base by 40% last year. So they're doing really well in terms of people being interested in their services.
Let me ask you a couple of questions before we get to the mid-program break. When they bring in new people, when they did that in stages, if I understand you, Are the new people that are brought in after their probation period, are they then fully equal members, no different basically in their decision-making power from those who started it at the very beginning? Because, you know, in some co-ops, that becomes a tension, that the that the old ones, the ones who started it, kind of because of the way we live in our society, think they ought to have powers that new ones do. How do they work that out?
Yeah, that's very familiar. Not initially. So when somebody is brought into the co-op to be trained and go through what they call a probationary period, they don't have a vote in the co-op. So they have to do specific trainings. They have to be evaluated by clients and the members. They have to attend meetings. They have to do publicity. And so after these three-month period, the members look back to see the trajectory of their probationary period and make a decision whether they're in or they're out. If they are decided to, if they are chosen to come in, they pay an investment into the co-op, which is not a huge amount, and then they get a vote, and they become the same as all of the other members. But to what you're referring to, I think they call the founder syndrome, definitely is happening in the co-ops. Yeah, I think it's a very natural thing. And so that is something that, you know, gets in the way sometimes, where the original generations, as they call themselves, the co-op members, are saying, I started this from nothing, you know, I know more than you. It's easy for you, but we try to balance that out with the great ideas and new visions that people have coming in newly in the co-op.
Is it possible that this kind of a model might have some special relevance to trying to get folks that are poor out of that situation, something which other programs that don't question how you organize business haven't been able to do? Tell us how that is shaping up as part of what you've learned and, and what you're doing in Brooklyn.
That's actually been very much at the core of why we've started doing this work. Absolutely. It's been, you know, a strategy, I think, to look at the fact that with the co-ops, people are trained in a way and kind of, you know, brought into the marketplace in a way that they otherwise wouldn't have been able to because of, you know, their low, not being skilled, not having the language necessary to pursue certain jobs. And so with this, I think they are brought in just very concrete examples. You know, with a co-op, they have contracts, for example, that they use with clients. And so they're able to negotiate with them and be able to really present themselves in a different way. So the messaging is really powerful. Also, coming at a client in a collective way, I think, really makes a difference in terms of, you know, the impact that they can have in their job economically. And so, this has been a really powerful tool, I think, for people to really kind of step out of their shell and be able to think of themselves differently and have a lot more agency over kind of how they're pursuing their ability to work in this country.
Yeah, it's the old lesson, I guess, that if you have a job you're proud of and you're working with people you feel good about, it changes you. As whatever work you do for others, you're also transforming yourself in the process. Yeah. And the defense and the argument for co-ops has always been that it's a much better way to live as a human being, to be part of a job where you have power, where you are part of the design and the direction of the job and not just a drone doing what other people tell you. What have been some of the problems? Let's be honest with our audience. What have been some of the major problems confronting this co-op, and how were those problems dealt with?
Yeah, so there's been numerous challenges along the way. First of all, we know that the majority of small businesses that start up fail in the first year, about 50%. And so to
that's not co-ops, that's all businesses.
All businesses across the board, yeah, this includes co-ops. And so it's a really big risk for people to just set aside their personal lives and also the fact that they live in a household, oftentimes, the community that I work with, where there are multiple earners, wage earners. And to really just do this for no wage, maybe for a year to 2 years, knowing that it might not work. So that's one big first hurdle to kind of go through. Another is, just to be completely, you know, transparent, the fact that when working in a co-op, you have to be very conscientious of your identity in the group and be able to use yourself in a professional way and to be an effective communicator, to be able to get things across and also to make progress. So there's definitely conflict that comes up, and that's something that we work with a co-op on. So that's a very real thing that I think sometimes co-ops themselves don't recognize in kind of the formation phase.
So the group process sort of.
Yeah, definitely. Another sort of issue that comes up is around, being able to develop your identity as a cooperator. So what I mean by this is that, you know, we live in a society where we're, you know, very accustomed to being typically an employee with an employer, following our boss's instructions, and then working 9 to 5, and that's it. And so in this case, you really have to kind of be able to unlearn that and take a leadership role and be able to be your own boss and to hold people accountable, and to be able to use that identity in different aspects of your life, not just in the workplace, but in the meetings, with your family, in the community. So it's really a fascinating kind of learning experience that, you know, takes some folks longer than others.
Tell me, how did you solve these problems? When you had people who couldn't do that, or who took a long time, or who resisted it, because of the way we live in our society, it's hard to work together with other people. That's why it's so hard to get movements going, mm-hmm. because it's a very individual. How did you solve these problems?
It's an ongoing job and work to kind of deal with these kinds of issues that come up. But basically, I think we have a certain model at the Center for Family Life that we work with the co-ops on, called social group work, where we basically help to kind of be very transparent about what's going on in a group. So if somebody's being confrontational about something, you know, we kind of make it known, and we try to work through those issues together. Sometimes it makes more sense to work within the committees. There's also a lot of rules that the co-ops have within their bylaws that they have to abide by and take certain steps if there's a problem with an individual or with two individuals together. So they take certain specific steps to kind of, you know, give a warning, maybe suspension, you know, whatever needs to happen. And then along the way, you know, it's definitely something that's brought up in terms of different workshops and being modeled, you know, by other cooperatives that we come across. So the networking, I think, is a really great aspect, you know, coming across other co-ops that are doing similar, that are confronting similar challenges and learning from them as well.
I want to pick up on that. Have there been spin-offs? Have there been other co-op, worker co-ops formed in Sunset Park, mm-hmm. in Brooklyn, that were brought into being, in a sense, by the success of Si Se Puede?
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about
definitely.
That.
Definitely. We learned so much from our experience with Si Se Puede that we've actually been doing incubation for the last 8 years with 7 additional cooperatives. So it's Si Se Puede is like the first one. And after that, we've worked with Beyond Care, which is a nanny cooperative, which I would say is as successful as Si Se Puede. They started out with 19 founding members and now are 35 and bringing in 12 new people. And then there's a few startups that we're working with.
What kind of work are these startups into? What do they do?
So one of them is called Trusty Amigos, and they're doing dog walking and pet sitting. Okay. They started last year. So they're about to launch next month, actually, to the public. Another co-op is called Golden Steps. It's an elder care, non-medical companionship service. And they work in all 5 boroughs, and they've been together for about 2 years. And then lastly, there is another co-op called Kickin' It, and it's mostly run by young people under the age of 25, providing soccer coaching and training to people in the neighborhood.
So it's very interesting. So it's a whole range of service industry mm-hmm. startups mm-hmm. that are set up as co-ops.
Yes.
Okay, tell me, based on all of this, what do you think about the co-op movement? You sit on the National Co-op mm-hmm. Organization. What do you think might be the role of co-ops in the United States? Here we are in an economy that is having a long-lasting crisis, that has millions of people unemployed, that is taking away job benefits and job securities from most people. Mm-hmm. We really all have that. It's only a question of the rate at which we're losing them, not whether we are. Where do co-ops and this movement that you're part of to build, where does that fit into all of that?
Mm-hmm. I think cooperatives have had a place in society, but can play a much larger role. And I think really it's an example that they set for a type of workplace that would benefit people on different dimensions, as you were mentioning, both economically but also in the human factor. So the fact that co-ops are run democratically to really make sure that people's voices are heard is something that we could really gain a lot from in this economy and the society, and really have the potential and have been actually to compete in the marketplace and to be able to really fit in the major in society. And so I think it really is something to look at, in contrast to all of the exploitative kind of workplaces that we're seeing, and to be able to go from that. So
yeah, I wanted to make a comment too. It's wonderful to hear the concrete reality of this on the ground, that it's working, that it is transforming people's lives. I am concerned, as I mentioned to you before the program, that the benefits of the co-op as a way to help unemployed people, poor people, immigrants, not take away from the fact that most people involved in co-ops are not from those groups, that co-ops are as important a way of becoming a full member of society, of realizing all your own individual potentials, which are not just to do work instructed by others, but to be part of the design of the instructions, to be part of the decision making, that this is a movement to change the way we organize work that really does, as it should, appeal to people across the bound. If it can also serve as a way to help deal with the problem of poverty, well, that's yet another benefit, another virtue this has had. And it is clear, that's why I introduced the Mondragon, that the most successful example is a place that started as a program to help poor people, but has since mushroomed to help all kinds of people that are neither Basque nor poor nor anything else, because it's a model that has such appeal. So tell me, are you going to be doing more? And particularly, I know many people have asked me, I want to start, they say to me in emails, I want to start a co-op, but I don't know anything about it. Sure. Who's going to help me? Tell us something about not only your group, but are there comparable groups around the United States that folks who want to start this thing can turn to for all the kinds of help and support and training that you provided in Brooklyn?
Yeah, that's a great question. We are going to definitely continue doing the work that we've been doing locally. We've also not only just been working with people in Sunset Park, but we've been training organizations around the city to become incubators, so that now the incubation is happening all around the city by these community-based organizations. But there's also other incubators and technical assistance providers around the country that are very much accessible and ready to help people that are wanting to start co-ops. For example, Green Worker Academy is in the Bronx, and they've been doing this for a long time. And then on a national level, there is the Democracy at Work Institute that are prepared, they're advisors that are in cooperatives that have been trained to provide technical assistance. So there is a lot of resources and help to be able to work with small groups of people, large groups of people, with whatever ideas that people may have to start co-ops. Definitely.
That's really wonderful to hear. And again, it reminds me at a certain stage in the development of the Mondragon Corporation in Spain, they set up what they call the Mondragon University. It actually is a university, has four different campuses in that area of Mondragon in the north of Spain. And they have an enormous program of training. People interested in starting or growing their co-ops, they teach them marketing, they teach them internal organization, communication skills, really formalizing everything you've said. And so maybe we can look forward to the United States that we can also develop the kinds of institutions, including universities, that can make this an alternative way of building an economy that isn't subject to the costs, the unemployments, the suffering, and the less human development that conventional enterprise.
Yeah, absolutely. We're going in that direction. And I know Mondragon has been an example for a lot of us in this community that we look to, as well as the co-ops in Italy. So we're very inspired by that. And I think a lot of people are really pushing themselves in this movement to really make this big.
Thank you so much, Vanessa,
thank
for
you
joining
so much, Richard,
and giving our audience a lesson in the concrete realities of worker co-ops.
You were just listening to an excerpt from Economic Update with host Richard Wolf. He spoke with Vanessa Brandsburg, who supports and builds successful worker co-ops in Brooklyn, New York. Stay tuned at 10 for Air Cascadia, and then at 10:15 we've got Flashpoints. Today's show was Turkish intelligence behind the use of sarin gas in Syria. Also, we'll feature an in-depth interview with Kathy Kelly on the battle against the expanding use of killer drones at home and abroad. At 11 o'clock on The Dirtbag, host Glenn Andreessen discusses easy and more complex methods of composting. And once again, thank you, KBOOM members, for your great support. You can become a KBOOM member if you're not one yet by going to kboo.fm and click where it says Donate Today. Thanks for doing that. We exist solely on the support of our listener members, and we'd greatly appreciate you going to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today to become a member if you're not one yet. Thanks so much. We're going to hear a little more music and then a message and eventually Air Cascadia at 10 o'clock. Thanks for tuning into KBOO today.
Sponsor of the 2014 Earth Day celebration, Saturday, April 26th, from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at Kenton Park on North Brandon and North Kilpatrick Streets in Portland.
The Earth Day 2014 theme, Reverse Migration, will focus on local culture and businesses. Over 100 sustainable businesses and organizations, including KBOO Community Radio, will participate in this event.
This celebration will also feature lots of live music and entertainment. Celebrate our planet at the 2014 Earth Day celebration, Saturday, April 26th, from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at Kenton Park. More information on this event can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And this is KBOO Portland.
morning, Cascadia. Today is Wednesday, April 9th, 2014, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, KBOO.FM on the web. We have a few headlines. We're going to try to speak with Kevin Gostola at Far Dog Lake on this baffling and somewhat dangerous comedy taking place Cuban cyberspace. If ever there was a story that seemed made up from whole cloth straight out of a William Gibson novel, it's got to be this one. And if anybody can speak to the issue, it's Kevin Gostola at Far Dog Lake. First, a few headlines, though, from around the region. Just when we thought it was safe to go back to the liquefied natural gas terminal, here come a flurry of earthquakes, which we are reassured by seismologists that we're perfectly safe from all of these earthquakes. But we do have to wonder, again, human impact on the environment, on the earth, has been fairly severe. And, well, how shall we say it, impactful in recent years, decades. And garbage in, garbage out, as the saying goes. You can't keep it up forever without repercussions. In the past 24 hours, the Pacific Northwest Seismic Network has recorded 17 earthquakes. The largest was a 2.4, which was 40 miles southwest of Penticton up in British Columbia. But the 2.4 quake was barely felt, like most of the many, many quakes that are documented every year. Though we had recently one near Sherwood. The deal with earthquakes being that if they're deep underground, they are felt over a wider area. And these have been shallower ones, so they've been contained. But a lot of seismic activity, plus a lot of rain, has a tendency to cause large land masses to travel down hills at a brisk clip, wiping out communities. And they're so unfortunate enough to be along the path. By the way, the death toll from Oso, Washington now stands at 33, confirmed, I believe. Last month, a non-profit Oregon Best announced that it and the Portland Development Commission were awarding $150,000 to a Wilsonville company developing, wait for it, drone technology. And we all know one thing, if nothing else, about technology. It can start out moving in one direction and switch vectors when the paying public least suspects it. The idea of using a drone for precision or any other kind of agriculture is, other than spraying pesticides and herbicides, which of course we know they'd never go and do that, would they? But it would be pretty much useless as far as obtaining any useful information regarding conditions, so to speak, on the ground. And can it really be happening? Could the American workforce be about to receive the shot in the arm it's needed for so long? The government's landmark Americans with Disabilities Act settlement with Rhode Island yesterday is expected to move people with profound who are profoundly differently abled out of low-paying jobs and sheltered workshops into the general workforce. It's a move that federal lawyers are calling a blueprint for the nation. What a breath of fresh air. Will this really happen? We'll find out. Last night, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton appealed to a crowd at Keller Auditorium, "Don't vote for people who proudly tell you they won't compromise." The audience at the Keller Auditorium predictably gave her standing ovations at the beginning and end of her speech. Super hot Clinton is widely considered to be campaigning, right, even as we speak, perhaps even as we sleep, for the Democratic presidential nomination of 2016. The Portland event began a week of speech making on several West Coast cities. He's, well, once again, turning aside questions about whether she would run again. Could this account for the seismic activity up and down the West Coast? Possibly, quite possibly. And here comes the Client Convergence Summit. That's coming up Monday, April 28th. Portland Rising Tide has all the information that you need to know to get yourself out and about and involved with that. Very, very important gathering taking place. That's coming up on the 28th, and as we get closer to that date, we invite people from Rising Tide to come on the show and talk about it, talk about why right now it is so critical to take this seriously. We are well out of time. And think first before you dismiss the idea altogether. The Josephine County Sheriff's Office is understaffed and desperate for help, so they're mulling whether to turn to local volunteers to help process crime scenes. Hooray, Josephine County, resorting to vigilantism to police their own citizenry. But everybody down there has guns anyway, so I suppose it made perfect sense at the time. How could what could go wrong, right? Famous last words. If other sentient beings exist somewhere out there, they must surely believe that planet Earth is the all-time intergalactic reality program / sitcom. Here's the proof. USAID secret Cuban Twitter program hired Ellen Lausanne Falcone, a Havana-born satirical artist based in Chile, to propose text messages to be sent to Cuban users. Neither Lausanne nor the Cuban subscribers realized that the U.S. government, USAID, in fact, USAID, always the mouthpiece, the good cop arm of the CIA,